Anatomy and Physiology, The Endocrine System, Part 1. This is just a figure from your book, and it shows a broad overview of all the organs and tissues in the endocrine system we'll be studying. So that's just a cute picture to look at. But let's get to it with this slide. I love this slide titled The Overview of the Functions of the Endocrine System. Don't let this slide scare you. It's not meant for you to immediately memorize a list. As we go through the endocrine organs and tissues, you'll learn all this stuff. But let's just look at this slide from perspective just to wow you. I mean, look at all the things the endocrine system regulates. Homeostasis, that's a constant normal internal environment. Our metabolic processes, fluid balance, our biological clock, regulation of cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands, which you know means controls the autonomic nervous system. Also, hormones help regulate some immune system functions, play a huge role in growth and development and reproduction. And so, what's not on this list? I mean, if I were a student looking at this first slide, I would just write down off to the side, hormones control everything. And, you know, if mommy asked you, hey, you took A and P, whatever, you should know a lot of stuff. How does this work or that or the other thing work in your body? You could almost always be right by just saying hormones. This is a great place in the course to compare and contrast the nervous and endocrine systems because they work together. So let's do a little bit of review. First of all, remember the nervous system. It releases chemicals called neurotransmitters that will either excite or inhibit a nearby nerve, muscle, or gland cell. Notice the word to write off to the side here is neurotransmitters work locally. They don't travel very far. And you get results extremely quickly. They happen in milliseconds. Usually it's fast on and fast off. Whenever I say that, those of you old enough, that might remind you of the same movie I'm thinking of. The original Karate Kid, there was a line they said, wax on, wax off. Well, that's how I think of the nervous system. It's fast on, fast off. As opposed to the endocrine system, which secretes chemicals called hormones, and hormones, when they come out of one of the cells that are part of the endocrine system, they leak out into the nearby interstitial fluid that you know surrounds our cells. Then they diffuse into a capillary, and capillaries, you know, are everywhere. Then the hormones travel throughout the body via the blood. In other words, they go a long way because you have capillaries all the way from the top of your head to the tip of your toes. Now, what about the results? There's a lag time between when the hormone is released and when it has its effect. Results may take seconds, hours, days, or even longer. What's the take-home point here that you should write down? A little bit of hormone goes a long way and lasts a long time. If you've ever taken any kind of hormones or you know anyone who's taken any hormones, I've taken them during my life, you know that the effects, they often reach out and touch many tissues in your body. And the effects last a long time, and sometimes the effects don't go away. So your patient should not mess with hormones. And then please recall, what hooks the nervous system and the endocrine system together? My favorite part of the human body, that small, powerful part of the brain that you know is called the hypothalamus. And really, if mommy asks you, hey, what controls this in my body? The complete one-word answer, there's a word called neuroendocrine. You could look that up to spell it. You could always say, mommy, it's under neuroendocrine control. And you would always be right because everything is under the control of either the nervous and or the endocrine system down to the nitty-gritty metabolic processes you learned earlier on in your A&P careers. Let's talk about the endocrine glands. There's a figure off to your right you could look at. It's kind of okay. But let's go through this. Five glands in your body are classified exclusively as the endocrine glands. Why did somebody make that definition? Because these five glands we're about to discuss, all they do is produce hormones. That is their primary job. So what are the five, if anybody ever asked you? They are the pituitary and the pineal gland, the thyroid and the parathyroid gland, and the adrenal glands. What's my memorization technique? Well, in class, I bring up the example of the Three Stooges. That, of course, is really old school, although I see they brought back a Three Stooges movie in recent years. And they were always taking two of their fingers and poking each other, like in the eyes. So what I do, not really, this is just an example, so don't do this, but I poke myself in the head with my two fingers. That reminds me of the pituitary and pineal glands in my head. Then I poke myself in my neck for my thyroid and parathyroid glands. Then I poke myself in my belly for my adrenal glands. And that's how I remember where my five different primary exclusive endocrine glands are and what they are. Now, there are many other organs and tissues that have some endocrine function. That is, they secrete hormones, but it's a secondary function. Don't worry about everything on this list. We either already did or will do these tissues in this course. I'll just touch on a couple of highlights. For example, we did the stomach. I mean, the stomach makes a hormone called gastrin, but is that the main job of the stomach? No, the main job of the stomach is digestive system. The kidneys, they make hormones. Remember erythropoietin and calcitriol, but are the kidneys mainly an endocrine system deal? No, they're mostly a urinary system deal. There's only two items on this list I want to talk about separately because we will not touch on them again in this course. The skin with a star on it. Yes, it is involved in processing a hormone. That's also a vitamin. Vitamin D can or does begin processing in the skin. Sunlight goes through the skin and helps in the activation process of a hormone called vitamin D. Vitamin D, to get fully activated, has to go next to the liver and finally to the kidneys. But yes, the skin is part of the endocrine system. What about the heart? Anybody remember a chemical we talked about that was made by the heart in response to volume overload? If we jacked Mr. Jones full of 10 bags of IV fluid in 10 minutes, of course his heart would get swollen with fluid and his atria made a chemical. I didn't tell you at the time it was actually a hormone. It was a chemical that told the kidneys to pee out sodium. It was a chemical made by the atria of the heart so they would not pop. I called it, in slang, the atria not pop hormone. Remember, it was called ANP. Write that down here. That's really called atrial natriuretic peptide. That was the pee out saltwater hormone that the atria made in response to volume overload. So yes, the heart is part of the endocrine system, but is it one of the primary exclusive five endocrine glands by your book's definition? No, of course not, because the heart is part of the, his main job is the cardiovascular system. Those of you who are sitting back maybe thinking about this a little bit are saying, now wait a minute, if hormones come out of these endocrine cells and they get in the blood, why don't hormones make every cell in your body do something? Thank goodness they don't do that, because we'd all be going wacky in one way or the other from a biochemical sort of standpoint. So hormones will only affect certain cells. They'll only affect target cells that have a specific protein in their cell membrane called a receptor. receptor. So here in your figure, it shows an endocrine cell spitting out a hormone. It's going through the blood, and it will only make a cell do something if it has a receptor, like a lock and a key hookup. And again, that's a good thing. Now, some of you are saying, well, I can remember that. That's easy, but I'll never see that used again in the real world. And I'll give you an example of where you will. Of course, breast cancer affects at least 1 out of 8 women, a devastating statistic. And one of the first things that you do when you diagnose breast cancer is you send that breast cancer tissue to the lab, and they examine it for the presence of what's called estrogen receptors. Let's say this is a breast cancer cell. Let's say this green thing is an estrogen receptors. It just so happens that the female sex hormone called estrogen, that's in a woman's veins, of course, if it lands on a breast cancer cell that does have an estrogen receptor, those breast cancer cells grow like wildfire. It's like dumping Miracle-Gro on a plant. So someone who knew a little bit about breast cancer and someone who knew a little bit about what's on this slide says, I know what I'll do. I will invent a drug that will save hundreds of thousands of women's lives. And they did. It's a drug that blocks the estrogen receptor. You could look it up. There's many like them. One example is a drug called tamoxifen, and it prevents estrogen from binding to and stimulating breast cancer cells from growing. And many women's lives have been saved through the invention of that drug. And with your knowledge you have, you could have thought of that too. So remember, you're not just here to get an A, you're here to help people. And if you think of a drug like that, by the way, please remember me and cut me in 1%. Your book classifies hormones two ways. This is the easy way, and it's short and it's simple. So let's do this first. You may classify hormones as to whether or not they are circulating or local hormones. Circulating hormones, you should write up here off to the side, are most hormones by far in the human body. And they do exactly what they say they do. They come out of the endocrine cell and they circulate through the blood throughout the body and act on distant target cells. This is what most hormones do in the body. However, there are also hormones called local hormones. Local hormones mean they don't go very far. For our studying pleasure, there are two types of local hormones. One is called a paracrine. Know your root word, para means next to. Paracrine hormones act on nearby or neighboring cells. Here's a figure from your book showing a paracrine hormone drifting to a receptor on a nearby target cell. There's another kind of local hormone called an autocrine hormone. Know your root word auto. Auto means self, like an autoimmune disease is where your immune system attacks yourself. Here's an example from your book, an autocrine hormone coming out of an autocrine cell landing on a receptor on itself. I want to give you an example that you may already know from immunology. When we did immunology, we already talked about a chemical. I didn't tell you it was a hormone, but it is. It was a chemical made by T helper cells that helped all other cells. It helped neighboring B cells. It helped to activate neighboring T cells. And it could even help itself. I didn't tell you that when we did immunology, but the T helper cell can even help itself with this chemical. The chemical was called interleukin. Write it down. It's something from immunology. And it's great when we bring back stuff from units we already did, because that's what helps long-term retention and understanding of material. There's another way to classify hormones. It's a much more complicated way. Sorry about this, but it's a much more useful way. As you will see, we can classify hormones based on whether or not they are lipid-soluble hormones or water-soluble hormones. Why is that important? Because that determines, number one, how the hormones get from the endocrine cell to the target tissue, and more importantly, it affects how the hormone works when it gets to the target cells. I know this is a little bit difficult. We got some heavy-duty physiology coming up. Please check out the voiceover PowerPoints. I know they sound a little bit dry. I don't know what I was thinking when I made those. I think I was in a coma or something. Please check out the embedded animations from your text. And please check out, under external links, under the lesson tabs, I have some great little video snippets that will help you understand visually what's going on as far as these hormone mechanism of actions. First, let's look at the two groups of hormones, then we'll talk about how they work. First comes the lipid-soluble hormones. What are the lipid-soluble hormones? You gotta know stone cold. They consist of, number one, the steroid hormones. And check this out. All the steroid hormones are derived from our old friend cholesterol with a star. All this stuff in the news about how bad cholesterol is, but look, we can't live without the proper amounts. It's in our cell membranes, it's in these steroid hormones, several of which we cannot live without. Remember too that cholesterol, most of it we get in our bodies because it's made by the liver. That's another great thing to write down here and another connection to make with a prior organ system we studied. Let me take a minute here while we're talking about the liver because I love the liver. Many people take medications to lower their cholesterol level. Okay, that's what you do if the cholesterol is too high. And guess where almost all those medicines work? They almost all work on the liver because that's where we make most of our cholesterol that's in our body. And if you ever known somebody who's on those medicines, or if you look at it online or on a package insert, there's always a warning on those. It says, make sure you have your liver function tested every so many whatever months while you're on this drug. Why? Because the medications that monkey with cholesterol levels are monkeying with the metabolism inside our liver cells, and it's possible to get liver damage. So sorry I digressed a little bit there, but it's great to make connections with old stuff we did. It really helps you retain and understand stuff better. So what are the steroid hormones derived from cholesterol? They include progesterone, estrogen, testosterone, and androgens. Let's stop there because that group of hormones has a name. You may have learned it in eighth grade health class. As a group, those are the sex hormones. Progesterone and estrogen are the female sex hormones. Testosterone and androgens are the male sex hormones. And then the other three steroid hormones derived from cholesterol are aldosterone, cortisol, and calcitriol, which is really just the most active form of vitamin D. So how do I remember that? What are the steroid hormones? The steroid hormones are the sex hormones plus the ACC. The ACC is for aldosterone, cortisol, and calcitriol. And how do I remember that? I take this mnemonic one step further. Okay, well, it's football season as I'm making this tape, and I love college football. And there's one football conference called the ACC. Of course, we know that has a lot of the weaker teams in there. And then I think, well, you know, some of those athletes, to try to keep up with the better divisions, like the SEC, of course, have to maybe resort to using these body-building sex hormones, like those male muscle-building hormones, like testosterone and androgens. So that's how I remember the steroid hormones include the sex hormones plus the ACC. Now look, before you go saying anything and sending me any nasty emails, that's just a memorization technique. I'm not really saying the SEC is better than ACC. I'm not saying anybody does or should, of course, take any of these male sex bodybuilding hormones, because that's illegal, of course. It's just an example, so lighten up. Okay, what is the next lipid-soluble hormone? It is called nitric oxide. And you need to write down off to the side here, this is a substance made by the endothelial cells of blood vessel walls. And what does it do? When it's released, it causes vasodilation. Let me give you an example, and we may as well hook it to the reproductive system. Let's talk about how the penis works. The penis is filled with vessels. It's called erectile tissue. And when nitric oxide is released locally, those vessels dilate and engorge with blood, and that's what leads to an erection. Someone who knew that said, hey, I know I can help people who have erectile dysfunction. I will invent a pill that essentially mimics the effects of nitric oxide. It's that little blue pill called Viagra, and that's how Viagra works. But does anybody know why Viagra was really invented? It's amazing if you want to do an internet search on this. It was actually invented for something else. There's a disease that's deadly in little kitties called pulmonary hypertension. It means blood pressure too high in the pulmonary vasculature, and that could lead to death. So someone who knew this basic physiology about nitric oxide and knew a little bit about the lungs said, hey, if I can make a drug that can dilate the vessels, the pulmonary vessels, we can decrease the pressure and treat pulmonary hypertension. So that's really why that substance was invented. And then they found the other thing happened as a side effect, and of course they ended up marketing the pill as Viagra for erectile dysfunction. But if you do an internet search, you'll see that Viagra is given in actually larger doses to children with pulmonary hypertension to save their lives. What's the last lipid-soluble hormone? They are the thyroid hormones. The thyroid hormones, by definition, are called T3 and T4. So how do I put it all together? Well, I already gave you mnemonic for the steroid hormones. The steroid hormones are the sex hormones plus the ACC. But now we could put it all together because I spelled the word here. We have S for steroids, we have NO for nitric oxide, and we have T for thyroid hormones. That spells snot. That's right, I'm not immune to stooping down the third grade bathroom humor if it helps us remember stuff. Snot are the lipid-soluble hormones. And you know, snot is kind of greasy, and lipids are greasy, so it helps me remember that snot are the lipid-soluble hormones. While you're making notes, maybe taking down some of my little tips and tricks here, I always get asked this question after class, and maybe you're thinking of it too, so I'm going to answer it right now. Someone after class always comes up to me or raises their hand and says, hey, wait a minute, nitric oxide, if that's what nitric oxide does, how come such and such doesn't happen when you get the gas at the dentist's office? Well, that's a different kind of gas. That's called nitrous oxide. That's laughing gas in layman's terms. So it's a different chemical. So that's the answer to that question if you're thinking of it. What are the water-soluble hormones? The water-soluble hormones include, number one, proteins, peptides, and amines. And to me, I just call this whole group the protein group because amine sounds like, and really kind of refers to in a way, amino acids, which make up peptides, and then peptides linked together make up proteins. So let's think of this whole category as the protein hormones. They include insulin, human growth hormone, and a whole mess of others. If you look in your book, there's 80 million hormones that fall into this category. The only two I want you to know by name are insulin and human growth hormone. Those are the two protein hormones you should commit to memory. You'll see why in a minute. The next type of water-soluble hormones are called eicosanoids. I know that's a big word, but you have to know it. And eicosanoids are derived from a substance you also have to know, wait for it, called arachidonic acid. If you don't think this is important, just wait till you do pharmacology. You're going to study this inside and out, backwards and forwards in great detail. Trust me, I try not to give you any trivial pursuit in my course. I know what's going to be clinically relevant for you in the future. And the two types of eicosanoids that you must know for my course are prostaglandins, one of our old friends we studied when we studied inflammation, and leukotrienes. So, do I have a mnemonic for the water-soluble hormones? Of course I do. I spell a word. P for the protein group, E for the two eicosanoids, which you must know are prostaglandins and leukotrienes. And then I finish my word off by writing a little W. W is for water. So I spell the word P-E-W, pew. So pew are the water-soluble hormones. So there you go. I gave you snot and I gave you pew. While you're making notes, let me give you a clinical example of how this classification is relevant and ties with what we studied in the digestive unit. So there's a question on the bottom of this slide. It says, how may hormones be administered? Well, it varies really depending on whether or not they're water-soluble or lipid-soluble. Look on this slide I'm on right now. Insulin and human growth hormone. At the time of this taping, there's really no significant known way to administer them orally. They're given as injections. Why? Because they're proteins. And we know that in our stomach, the stomach just pulverizes proteins. So there's no way to absorb them. Your body doesn't have a chance. So you have to do it as an injection. If we flip back to the other slide, to the snot slide, are these things able to be given orally? You bet. I mean, look at the male and female hormones are on there. Vitamin D is on there. Viagra. Nitric oxide's on there, thyroid hormones, which many people take. You can take it as a pill. Why? They're lipid-soluble. They can get across the phospholipid bilayer of your cell membranes very quickly in your GI tract before they have a chance to become digested. So that's why you can give snot by mouth. And that's another memorization technique. You know, when you swallow snot, you can swallow snot. So you can also swallow the snot hormones because they're the lipid-soluble hormones. The reason we classify things as water and lipid-soluble has great importance, as we just mentioned. It also affects, for example, how they get from point A to point B. So how do water-soluble hormones get from the endocrine cell to the target cell? Very easily, because your blood has a lot of watery plasma in it, and water mix just fine, so they circulate what's called in free form in the blood before hitting on their target cell. But what about lipid? Lipid and water don't mix, just like in a salad dressing bottle, they don't mix. So lipid-soluble hormones need help to travel through the blood. They must attach to a transport protein. That's the big difference between the two. Next, we'll talk about how the lipid-soluble and water-soluble hormones work. Again, please look at the extra goodies I have as far as animations and so forth to help you with this. These are some of these biochemical pathways that we all have to learn one time. I know they probably go in one ear, out the other. I'll roll through them one time with you, but you'll probably have to do it six times at home. But really, please just focus on the major bullet points for me. Let's talk first about the action of lipid-soluble hormones. I'll do it first with words, second with a matching picture that matches my bullet points, and then again, you could do more review at home. So how do lipid-soluble hormones work once they get to the target cell? Here it goes. The hormone diffuses out of the blood, and then when it reaches the target cell, since these are lipid-soluble, they can cut right through the phospholipid bilayer and get right into the cell. Because, you know, lipids mix with lipids just fine. It's like butter going through butter, no problem. When the hormone gets into the cell, this is key. It binds to a receptor inside the cell. It might be in the cytosol, it might be in the nucleus, but the key is the hormone binds to a receptor inside the cell. And that hormone receptor complex either turns on or turns off specific genes within the cell. And genes control pretty much a lot of stuff. Genes direct the formation of new messenger RNA. And messenger RNA, almost always what it does is direct synthesis of new proteins. You studied that earlier on in A&P. And these new proteins, by the way, that your cells make are often enzymes, which are underlined with a star, because that new protein, that enzyme, is what directs or alters that cell's activities. A big picture bullet point here is that you should take away from anatomy. Enzymes are necessary to make almost any metabolic reaction in the body happen that you could possibly think of. So you can hopefully understand how powerful and all-controlling our hormones are. Let's look at it again using a picture. Here's what I just said. Here comes the green lipid-soluble hormone. Remember, it needs help getting through the watery plasma. It's attached to this blue transport protein, kind of looks like a wrench. It lets go of the lipid-soluble hormone. It diffuses out of the blood capillary and right through that phospholipid bilayer, gets into the cell, and binds to a receptor inside the cell. That activated receptor hormone complex then alters our genes. It tells the genes to make messenger RNA. Messenger RNA, as you know, directs synthesis of a specific protein. That new protein is often an enzyme which regulates our metabolic processes. Wow, I know you're going to have to review that a few times, but boy, is that powerful, isn't it? What about water-soluble hormones? I'm sorry, I'm just the messenger, but it's a much longer process. I'll do it once on the words and once on the pictures. But then go home and work on it a few times. So here we go. Water-soluble hormones, they diffuse from the blood, then they bind to proteins on the cell membrane because the water-soluble hormone can't get through the fat of the phospholipid bilayer. In this case, the hormone is given a name. It is called the first messenger with a star. The hormone receptor complex on the cell membrane then activates something else called a G protein in the membrane. And I just remember it this way. The hormone receptor complex has to get things going, and it gets things going by activating a G protein. But that's not enough. Once you activate the G protein, you kind of have to keep the cycle going. How do you keep the cycle going? By activating an enzyme called adenylate cyclase. Adenylate cyclase converts ATP to cyclic AMP, which is called CAMP for short, in the cytosol. CAMP is, by definition, called the second messenger. That's because the hormone couldn't get inside the cell. So the hormone was called the first messenger. CAMP is called the second messenger because it's really going to now carry out the action. Look what CAMP does. CAMP activates enzymes with a star. The enzymes are called protein kinases which are located in the cytosol. And those enzymes, called protein kinases, either speed up or slow down some physiological process within that cell. I think of it this way, protein kinases with a K, either kick things up a notch or kick things down a notch in a cell. This mechanism is so powerful. If you check out some video clips that I have or on the internet, you'll see that there's a built-in amplification process in this mechanism. So your body has to have a way to shut it down or control it. So the last thing on the slide I want you to know is inside of our cells, there's another enzyme called phosphodiesterase, which inactivates CAMP. It shuts the CAMP down. It turns it off. Cells must have a way to shut the cycle down because water-soluble hormones, even at very low concentrations, can have a very powerful amplified effect. Here's the picture of what we just talked about. So here comes the water-soluble hormone floating through the blood plasma. It gets out of the blood capillary. It can't get through the fat sandwich of the cell membrane, so it binds to this red receptor in the cell membrane. The hormone, again, is called the first messenger, and the hormone receptor complex gets things going by activating this blue G protein. Then we have to keep the cycle going by the G protein activating an enzyme called adenylate cyclase. Adenylate cyclase converts ATP to cyclic AMP, which is the second messenger. We sort of accomplished our main mission by doing that. CAMP then activates enzymes called protein kinases. The protein kinases will either kick things up a notch or kick things down a notch. Finally, we have to have a way to shut the cycle down. We have to have a way to shut down or close down the CAMP, and that is through our fifth step, our enzyme called phosphodiesterase. I know that's a long pathway. It's one of those things we all go through. While you're making notes, let me tell you about how this is involved in the real world sometimes. There's a disease called cholera, often happens in third world countries when water gets contaminated, and the cholera toxin takes advantage of this mechanism in our guts. The epithelial cells lining the guts, what happens is the cholera toxin binds to a receptor on our intestinal cells. It kind of gets this whole cycle going, and what the cholera toxin tells our cells to do is to secrete a lot of chloride. Of course, salt goes with the chloride and water follows the salt. And you may have already heard that cholera patients, they just have profuse watery diarrhea, and if you don't replace their fluid and electrolytes, they can die very quickly because of this mechanism that we discussed. It's a very powerful mechanism. Here's an embedded animation. Please check these out. I hope they're helping you. Now let's talk about some of our specific organs and tissues in the endocrine system. Let's start with my favorite part of the body. Here it is in a drawing. I put a red box around it. That's the hypothalamus, small but powerful part of the brain. It is attached to the pituitary gland below by a stalk called the infundibulum. I know in high school they told you the pituitary gland was the master gland, but it's not. They messed you up in high school. The hypothalamus is the king. It's the master of the master. And yes, we've already discussed the hypothalamus receives input from many different parts of the brain. Many different internal organs have connections with it. It's so powerful. It is, one more time, the major link between the nervous and the endocrine systems. Let's talk more about it. The hypothalamus produces 9 different hormones. And I'm going to take it easy on you here because the 9 hormones have 9 different names. And this really is a survey course, and I thought it was too trivial to give you all 9 names, so I'm going to going to boil it down and make it a little bit simpler, because I want you to take from my course the things that are big time, clinical, long-term things you got to know. So here we go. Five of the nine hormones I'm going to let you call just releasing hormones. And the releasing hormones do just what they say they do. They're going to go down to the anterior pituitary gland and tell it to release something. Two of the nine hormones are called inhibiting hormones. Inhibiting hormones are going to come down from the hypothalamus, land on the anterior pituitary gland, and tell it to not release something. That's why they're called inhibiting hormones. So there's seven of the nine hormones there, just all grouped together. Those are regulatory hormones. The two I want you to know by name are our old friend ADH and one more called oxytocin. So altogether, there's nine hormones. Let's specifically look at ADH and oxytocin, the two you have to know by name. ADH and oxytocin are produced by and sent down from the hypothalamus. They travel along nerves, that's right, axons, to the posterior pituitary, which holds them. It stores them. Then when called upon, when triggered by nerve impulses, those hormones, ADH and oxytocin, are released from the posterior pituitary into blood capillaries. I want to talk about ADH in more detail. I know we've already done it, but it's so important. We're going to learn some new tricks that ADH has up its sleeve. Remember, this really means the don't urinate hormone. My other memorization techniques were you can call it the anti-dehydration hormone or the add H2O hormone. But there's another name for ADH. You will use it. You will inject it in the hospital. It's known as vasopressin, and that's a great synonym. I love the word. Vaso means vessels. Press sounds like pressin or pressure. And sure enough, we're going to see one of the new actions of ADH is to press on or squeeze our vessels to increase our blood pressure. So I love that name. ADH, remember, is released from the hypothalamus in response either to low blood volume or high blood osmolarity. Remember, that's our classic dehydrated patient, for example. So in other words, ADH will be released if my volume is low, maybe I have a stab wound and I'm bleeding out, or again, maybe I'm dehydrated. And then what does ADH do to try to save me? Number one, it goes to our kidneys and it tells the kidneys to hold on to water, which decreases our urine output. So number one, this is old news. ADH goes to our kidneys, says hold on to water, don't urinate it out. But look what else it does to help us. It goes to our sweat glands and says, don't sweat it out either. And then third, it goes to our arterioles. It constricts them, which increases our blood pressure. So that's why it's called vasopressin. It has a triple whammy effect to help your patients who are, say, in cardiovascular collapse. Don't pee it out, don't sweat it out, and then it clamps down on your vessels, does everything it can to hold on to volume and raise our blood pressure. If you don't think it's important, I'll tell you three clinical uses right off the top of my head. You'll use it in people to rescue them. So it's on the crash cart when you're doing CPR. If someone's in cardiovascular collapse, you can jack them up with vasopressin to try to get up their vital signs and raise their blood pressure. Also, there's a disease I mentioned earlier in the course called diabetes insipidus. These are people usually with head injuries. They bruise the hypothalamus. They can't make ADH. They can't hold their water. And they could pee out up to 20 liters a day. And you could give them ADH injections. Also, there's a condition called nocturnal enuresis. Don't worry about writing that down. That just means bedwetting. And there are some patients who will take ADH, vasopressin, to help with bedwetting problems. So yes, I love ADH. It's important. You'll use it.
This is one of those pictures from your book. There's
nothing new on this slide. If this picture helps you, if it works with your brain, use it. If you're like me, this boggles my brain. I don't like these slides. I tear them up and throw them out. But if you like them, use them.
Now we talk about oxytocin. And right here on this slide, instead of oxytocin, I want you to write down, I want you to misspell it, at least for here, oxytensin.
Because oxytensin helps me remember what it does. It tenses smooth muscle in two target organs. I know these pictures from your texts are kind of rinky-dink, kind of cartoony images. But anyway, oxytocin is going to tense the smooth muscle in both the uterus and in the mammary glands. Let's talk about them individually. First, during delivery, the baby's head gets wedged down here in the cervix and it stretches some stretch receptors. And that hurts. And those pain signals are sent up to the brain, up to the hypothalamus, telling the hypothalamus, hey, baby's on the way, let's get rolling here. So the hypothalamus lets down some oxytocin, and oxytocin stimulates smooth muscle contraction in the uterus. And that pushes the baby's head even further down into the cervix, and the cervix gets stretched even more. And that hurts even more, like I know. But in any case, more pain signals from the uterus get sent to the hypothalamus, then more oxytocin comes down, which contracts the smooth muscle in the uterus, and the cycle continues until the baby is squished out. This is a rare example, the only example I'll ever give you of what's called a positive feedback loop. Write this down and draw a little figure. A positive feedback loop means the more you have of something, the more you get. So in this case, oxytocin is in a feedback loop with pain. So I'll use my little arrow and draw like a graph, a pretend graph. The more pain we have, the more oxytocin we have. The more pain, the more oxytocin. The more pain, the more oxytocin. That is a positive feedback loop. It's very rare in the human body. For example, every other hormone that I'll discuss with you in this course operates by something you must know called a negative feedback loop. That means the more you have of something, the less you want and the less you get. The less you have, the more you get. The more you have, the less you get. So I just draw a line on a graph like this, and I think of it like a thermostat controls your house. You want to be in homeostasis. That's how almost every other hormone in the body is regulated. Let's move on to the other target tissue of oxytocin, and those are the mammary glands. After delivery, when the baby suckles on the breast, those signals are sent to the hypothalamus. Oxytocin comes down through the blood, as you know, hits some smooth muscle cells in the mammary glands and causes milk ejection. Not milk production, milk ejection. Okay, while you're making notes, I'll give you some clinical relevance of this. When you rotate through the OBGYN floors, maybe you've been on the floors where babies are being delivered, and the doctor has an early tea time in the morning and doesn't have time to wait around for the baby to come out. What do? In the IV bag, they put a chemical in there. That chemical is called pitocin. Pitocin is just oxytocin. Read the vial. When you're the nurse putting it in the IV bag, you're just putting oxytocin in the IV bag to hurry up the delivery so the doctor can make it to his golf game. Okay, now I'm just kidding around. I know most of the doctors in town. I don't want any emails or phone calls. I'm just giving you a little funny story to hopefully remember things. But oxytocin does speed up the delivery, and it's also useful. It speeds up also the afterbirth comes out sooner, and also oxytocin has the beneficial effect of constricting the blood vessels as the smooth muscle gets constricted, and that does decrease bleeding as well. What about in the old days? In the old days, of course, they couldn't hang an oxytocin drip. But in the old days, they knew a little bit about this. Because hundreds of years ago, when somebody was delivering twins, let's say the first baby came out. Then the second baby got hung up in the birth canal. What did the nurse, midwife, or whatever they called them back then, what did they do to get the second baby to come out faster? They took the first baby and they had the first baby suckle. And that suckling caused oxytocin to come down, and that caused the second baby to come out faster. So even hundreds of years ago, they sort of kind of knew that this mechanism worked. They probably didn't know the physiology, but that's what they did in years ago when they delivered twins based on this mechanism. Now we get to talk about the pituitary gland. Let's start with a little bit of anatomy. Going to throw a synonym on you here because it's used in the hospitals and in the medical literature. The pituitary gland is also called the hypophysis. All it means is the undergrowth, and it is kind of growing under the hypothalamus. You'll see the term hypophyseal tumor or what have you. So I hate to throw double names on you, but this one is used often in the real world. It is a P-shaped gland found in a little divot called the pituitary fossa of the sella turcica of the sphenoid bone. That should ring some bells from bone anatomy. You remember the sphenoid bone shaped like a butterfly? And in the butterfly, there was something called the sella turcica. That means a saddle. And there's a divot in there. Divots in anatomy are called a fossa. So I just picture the pituitary gland riding in a little saddle in the butterfly called the sphenoid bone. And that's just a weird visual I have, but I never forget the location and the anatomy. What's the importance of that? Why am I hitting on that again? Because you will see scans come back on people, and the MRI scan will say, your patient has a tumor in the fossa. A lot of times they're referring to the pituitary fossa. Likewise, the radiologist might say on the MRI report, your patient has a tumor in the cellar, S-E-L-L-A-R, a cellar tumor. That doesn't mean they have a tumor in the basement. It means they have a pituitary tumor in the sella turcica. So that's why you got to know the anatomy again. Let's break down the pituitary gland. Fortunately for my pea brain, it only has two major parts. A big part in the front called the anterior pituitary and a smaller part in the back called the posterior pituitary. In the anterior pituitary, there are five different pituitary cell types that make at least seven different hormones. The anterior pituitary is where the action is, as opposed to the posterior pituitary, shown here in yellow. It's just made of axons and axon terminals. No hormones are made. Only two hormones are stored and released there that we already talked about. They're our old friends, ADH and oxytocin. So the posterior pituitary gland doesn't produce, it doesn't make or create diddly squat. It just holds those two things and releases them when called upon. This slide emphasizes once again in anatomy, if you don't understand the blood supply of an organ, you don't understand how it works. So let's review the blood supply of the anterior pituitary gland, because that's where the action is, and let's talk about control of secretion of its hormones. So it goes like this. Regulatory hormones from the hypothalamus, the king above, remember, either called releasing or inhibiting hormones, will enter a blood capillary network surrounding the hypothalamus. They will travel through a very special set of veins called the hypophyseal portal veins. Remember the beauty of a portal vein. It carries blood from one capillary network to another capillary network without passing through the heart. You should write down here, it's a quick, undiluted shot. The form matches the function. That's the beauty of a portal vein. Then those regulatory hormones enter a second capillary network that's located around the anterior pituitary gland, and they tell the anterior pituitary gland what to do. I put a little animated visual on here, so here it goes. I'm going to push the button. Boom. That's kind of neat. That's advanced PowerPoint. Don't try that at home. I don't want you to hurt yourself. You might be thinking to yourself, oh my gosh, he just said there's 9 hormones made by the hypothalamus and 7 hormones made by the pituitary gland. How in the world do they know what to do? Well, of course, we just discussed some of that on this slide, but the other key thing to know is they work by negative feedback loops. All but one work through negative feedback loops. Let's break down the anterior pituitary hormones. There are 7 different hormones produced by 5 different pituitary cell types. I used to ask the students to memorize the name of those pituitary cells, but that's one of those things that goes in one ear and out the other. And I'd rather you memorize, not just memorize, I'd rather you understand and retain the big picture. So that's what I'm going to give to you. Here are the 7 hormones. Yes, you must know the 7 different names. Yes, you must know the little abbreviations, because the abbreviations are what show up on the lab slips all the time in the hospitals. Don't let the names scare you. The names, like so many times in anatomy, tell us a lot about either location or function. For example, let's take a glance at these right now. Guess what human growth hormone is going to do? It's going to make you grow. Guess what prolactin is going to make you do? It's going to make you produce milk. Guess what thyroid stimulating hormone is going to do? It's going to stimulate your thyroid gland. It's not rocket science. Make it easier than it is, not harder than it is. We'll look at them one at a time in this order. The other thing I want you to take home from this slide is I grouped the hormones in 5 groups, indicating that those hormones are made by 5 different cells. Why is that important? Because pituitary tumors are actually quite common. If we autopsied everyone on the planet, 1 out of 10 of them would have a pituitary tumor. The good news is it would be a benign tumor. That's why you don't hear so much about it. But they can be malignant as well, or they can cause clinical problems. And here's the deal. A tumor usually starts from one cell. It's one cell that goes wacky and then starts multiplying like wildfire and makes a lump called a tumor. And so when you see someone with a pituitary tumor, they come to you with usually one problem. Like, for example, they may have a growth disorder, or they may be leaking milk from their breasts, or maybe they'll develop a suntan all of a sudden without laying out in the sun. So they come to you with one thing, because a tumor starts from one cell. Someone with pituitary tumor doesn't come into you saying, I have a growth problem, plus I'm leaking milk out of my breast, plus my skin cells are getting dark, plus my thyroid's out of whack. That's not how they present. They present with one of these problems because a tumor comes from one cell. Also on this slide, I'm going to give you a mnemonic to write down, because you do have to memorize all 7 hormones. The mnemonic I'll give you is flat miles per gallon, or just put FLATMPG. And that stands for FSH, LH, ACTH, thyroid stimulating hormone, melanocyte stimulating hormone, prolactin, and growth hormone. And yes, that spells flat MPG. So that's a little helpful device for you. Let's look at them one at a time, starting with human growth hormone. And by the way, your anterior pituitary gland spends most of its time every day making this hormone. This is the biggest job of the anterior pituitary gland.
All these hormones, remember, we're about to say, all seven of them are made by the anterior pituitary gland. And yes, they're all made in both males and females. Human growth hormone. Hey, let's look at the name. Guess what it does? It makes you grow. So it's easy. And it's called HGH for short. When I was in school, we didn't know as much as they know now. When I went to school, they said, human growth hormone comes out of the pituitary, goes to your tissues, and makes them grow. Well, that's not exactly true. What really happens is HGH comes out of the anterior pituitary. It goes to tissues like the liver and other tissues in your body. It makes them produce a second hormone called insulin-like growth factors with four stars. And then the IGFs, for short, the IGFs then go to our tissue cells and they cause the cells to increase protein synthesis, which promotes the growth, the maintenance, and repair of our body tissues, especially including, for example, our muscles and our bones. I'll give you a secondary function of both HGH and IGFs, a very important one that you have to know. They go to the liver and they tell the liver to release glucose into the blood. That second function should make sense to you. I mean, if we're growing, we need energy. If we need energy, we need sugar. So, two key functions that go together. What controls levels of HGH in our body? They are mainly controlled by blood glucose levels. How about that? Growth hormone is in a feedback loop with blood glucose. And it goes like this. The lower your blood sugar is, the higher the release of growth hormone. The higher your blood sugar is, the lower your growth hormone goes. So that is what growth hormone is in a negative feedback loop with. Kind of surprising to many of you. But check this out. What did mommy tell you when you were little? Mama said, don't eat so much of that junk sugary food because you're not going to grow up and to be big and strong. And she was right, because high blood sugar lowers growth hormone levels, and it really does stunt your growth. There's an article came out not too long ago. You could do an internet search, but for example, those sugary juice boxes that we give to our kids, if they drink too many of them, it literally stunts their growth compared to what they would have been if they didn't have that. And that makes me think back to, you know, decades ago when I was driving to Disney World 24 hours with four kids in the back seat, and we're doing anything to keep them quiet. I mean, I'm shoving juice boxes back there, M&Ms, Skittles, whatever it took to take them to be quiet. And man, I was probably stunting their growth. No, I didn't really do that. That's just an example that was supposed to be kind of funny, maybe help you remember. But here's a real example. A student in one of my face-to-face classes one year said, she raised her hand. She said, hey, Dr. Gonchore, Mr. Smarty Pants Know-It-All, what about type 1 juvenile diabetics? Since they have high sugar early in their lives, do they have stunted growth? And I said, you know, that sounds really good. That's probably true. How about if you get an article on that, and I'll give you a couple of bonus points on the test coming up. Sure enough, when I Googled that when I went home, you can do it too. Juvenile diabetics with poorly controlled blood sugars do have stunted growth. They are shorter compared to what they would have been if they didn't have diabetes or if they had better control of their sugar. So, yeah, that's true. Also notice at the bottom of the slide, what else increases our growth hormone levels? Deep sleep and vigorous physical exercise. And this all goes back to mommy. This is how I remember this forever. Mama said, don't eat junk food, get a lot of sleep, get your exercise, and you will grow up to be big and strong. And she was right. She didn't know why she was right, but she was right. It's all explained on this slide. Here again comes one of those figures from your books. There's nothing new on this slide. If this slide helps you, use it. If it doesn't, tear it up. Let's talk about some clinical stuff.
If you have hyposecretion or too little secretion during childhood, you know, before those growth plates fuse, the child will be a dwarf. If there is hyper or too much secretion during the childhood years, the child will have giantism. They'll grow up to be extra big. What about hypersecretion as an adult after the growth plates are fused? We can't grow any taller, but they can develop a condition called acromegaly. What that is you get thickening of your hands, your feet, your skull, your skin, and it can be very grotesque. Some patients get this from tumors of the pituitary gland. Some patients will get it because you may have heard in the news, some people believe that human growth hormone is the fountain of youth. If it was, believe me, I would already tried it out. It's not. People have gone to Mexico for growth hormone injections and they get this distortion of their tissues. And remember, a little bit of hormone goes a long way, lasts a long time, and once they get these problems, they don't go away. This reminds me, too, of some athletes, been in the news, some baseball players in recent years been in the news, and they've been accused of taking growth hormone. Of course, they deny it to no end, but I look at them, and I already knew they took it. For example, they have these, when they're 30 years old, they have these baby faces, so to speak, and then 10 years later, they get this big face that's way different than it was, you know, when they were 30, and that just doesn't happen overnight like that. I knew they were taking growth hormone just by looking at their facial changes over a short period of years. This is a picture from your book. It shows you off to your left a man with pituitary giantism, and to the right, his identical twin, who is clearly much shorter and smaller in size. This is a patient who has acromegaly. Again, you don't have the before picture, but there's increase in the bone and skin tissue thickness in his forehead and his nose and in his jaw. This again could come from a tumor or it could come from injection of HGH, and the effects don't go away. Our next hormone from the anterior pituitary gland is called follicle stimulating hormone, or FSH. Guess what it's going to do? Well, one of the functions it's going to stimulate a follicle. So let the name help you, but let's break it down because we have to know more than that. Here's a little cartoony picture from your book showing the target organs. The target organs are the gonads, which are the female ovaries and the male testicles. FSH stimulates development of something we'll learn called follicles within the ovary. Furthermore, it stimulates the follicular cells to secrete the hormone called estrogen. It would serve you well for real life and for the reproductive unit and for your female patients to think of FSH as equaling estrogen. The other target tissue is the testicles, and in the testicles, FSH stimulates sperm production. I have a mnemonic, don't worry, to help you remember this. I just spell a word, F-E-S-H, FESH, because that stands for, the F is for follicle, the E is for estrogen, the S is for sperm, and the H is for hormone. So FESH, F-E-S-H, stands for the follicle estrogen sperm hormone, and that's the way I remember it for real life and for the test. Then comes luteinizing hormone, abbreviated LH. Luteinizing, the root word, refers to something we'll study in the reproductive unit. It refers to something that is a yellow structure called the corpus luteum in the ovary. But let's break it down here because we'll learn more about that later. What are the functions of LH? LH goes to the ovaries in a woman and stimulates ovulation. Yes, the big mid-cycle LH surge in a woman results in ovulation once a month. Then it results in formation of a structure, a yellow structure inside the ovary called a corpus luteum, which just means yellow body. And then it stimulates production of progesterone. That's another female sex hormone by the cells of the corpus luteum. So it, again, would serve you very well to think of LH as equaling progesterone in your female patients. You'll see how that comes into play later in life. In males, what does it do? It stimulates the testicles to secrete testosterone. So how do I remember it? Because that's a lot of functions. This is the hardest one to remember. I spell a word. L-O-C-U-P-T. Well, I guess it's not a real word, but it's a mnemonic. Lock up. You got to have this all locked up on test day, right? So the L stands for LH. The O stands for ovulation. The C stands for corpus luteum. The U just stands for up, because next comes P. Up goes progesterone in a woman. And the T stands for testosterone, and up goes testosterone in a man. So to get LH all down for the test, you have to have it all locked up. So just spell L-O-C-U-P-T, and you'll know what LH does. Then comes prolactin, abbreviated PRL. This one's easy. Pro kind of sounds like produce. Root word lact means milk. So prolactin stimulates secretion of milk. Both pregnancy and suckling will increase prolactin levels. And remember, prolactin produces the milk. What causes ejection of the milk? Yep, that was our old friend, oxytocin. Don't mix them up. Again, if a man comes to you in the clinic and says, "Doctor, I'm leaking milk from my breasts," the first thing you'll think of is a pituitary tumor of the cell that produces prolactin. You'll do an MRI scan, and sure enough, you'll probably find a tumor of his pituitary gland. The next hormone from the anterior pituitary is called, this is a mouthful, adrenocorticotropic hormone that all my friends on the weekend when we're drinking soft drinks together, we call it ACTH. Let's break down the words. It means adrenal cortex make something. So ACTH is a hormone from the anterior pituitary gland that goes to the adrenal cortex and tells the adrenal cortex to produce cortisol. So ACTH, adrenal cortex produce cortisol. Melanocyte stimulating hormone, or MSH. This one should be easy by looking at the words. It stimulates melanocytes in your skin to produce melanin. Function in humans really is controversial if you look this up on the internet, but certainly an excess amount of MSH in our body may cause increased skin pigmentation. So if someone comes to you looking like they got a suntan and they say, "Doctor, I don't even lay out in the sun," there's a lot of disorders you'll look at, but one of them is you better check the MSH levels and check out their pituitary gland. The last hormone from the anterior pituitary gland is called thyroid stimulating hormone, abbreviated TSH, and you guessed it, TSH stimulates the thyroid gland to produce the two thyroid hormones, which you should know as T3 and T4.